stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're tuned into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. My name is Kingsley Kipuri. I'll be your host for the next hour. I'm joined in studio by Greg Nicholson. Greg, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Kingsley.
It's been a while, man. I just wanted to start with something a bit exciting, man. That song, that's K-9, Wave Your Flag, we just played. It always reminds me of 2010 World Cup, man.
Fantastic memories.
Man, I just remember the vuvuzelas, the excitement. It just fills me with this proudly South African spirit.
The question is, are you still proud after the allegations and the Hollywood-style FBI bust? FIFA officials last week.
I love how you saw it, because you really saw it as these like mafia bosses, these European bosses from out of Taken 2 in Zurich and Switzerland. I don't know, I feel like it's just not a bunch of, I don't know, like normal guys, accountants, sort of just, you know.
I think I see it that way because the way the FBI and I think it was the US Attorney General hyped it up, you know. It makes it seem like they got these guys at 6 a.m. in the morning in a Zurich hotel. And, you know, the way I see it is I imagine them smoking cigars still up all night, throwing money at strippers or something like that, you know?
It did kind of feel like that. I'm trying to find the quote you tweeted, but the Attorney General had this great press conference you were talking about, and it was just completely epic, man. There were just like all these puns about red cards and putting the, what did they say? Something like pulling the red card on corruption.
All of the language they used around the arrests and indictments were football metaphors. It was like, I think some of the US authorities have gotten so Hollywoodized, I guess, that everything they do is almost like made for movies, you know? It's just they're living real life scripts as they act. But it was dramatic.
Absolutely, man. For everybody tuning in, as you've guessed, we'll be spending the first half hour of our show talking about all the corruption and bribery allegations at FIFA. So we had some of the top officials being arrested by European police, and this has actually sort of started coming home to South Africa. And there's questions around what does this mean for the World Cup we hosted in 2010? And is it possible that South Africa actually bought the rights to hold the World Cup through illegal channels, of course?
And was it value for money if we did buy it?
I mean that's something I'm quite interested about talking about. I mean, it sounds terrible to say the corruption was valid. But when we step back and think about it, in terms of the jobs created for the country, in terms of the economic boost, in terms of the prestige and the global prestige, was it worth it for South Africa?
And that K-9 moment, the national cohesiveness, man, that everybody seems to look back on like it was a golden time of South African society and relations, a 95 moment, you know?
I mean, and that's what we were talking about. I think there was these links to the 95 World Cup and how that's held up as such a glorious moment for the Rainbow Nation. And maybe we were just trying to relive that in 2010.
Just trying to search for it again and just put it on repeat.
We'll be talking shortly to Antoinette Mueller from the Daily Maverick, who's been writing extensively on this. I'm just trying to see if we can get her on our Skype line. Antoinette, are you here?
I'm here.
Fantastic. Antoinette, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. Okay, I'm just getting the volume right. Now, Antoinette, you've been writing a lot about this, and to be honest, I've been getting lost amongst the details. Could you just give us an update on where we are with the FBI arrests and indictments and what's going on?
Well, I've actually also, I've just been out for a while and I just came back home, and I've just seen that there's actually a letter that has now surfaced from 2008, written by the South African SAFA president at the time, addressed to Jerome Falk, actually authorizing the $10 million payment to be paid from the fund of the local organizing committee to the Diaspora Legacy Program, as they call it. So, In technical terms, South Africa have actually admitted that there was $10 million that went from the local organizing committee to somewhere where it wouldn't be or where it shouldn't have been. And these accounts, of course, are allegedly controlled by Jack Warner, who's a very dubious man and has been for quite some time, and good friends with Chuck Blazer, who's otherwise known as, you know, he's sort of a comedy former soccer dad, and again, everything sounds very Hollywood. So, to be honest, at the moment, having just come in and seen this data, I'm also a bit lost. But in basic terms, a bunch of people were arrested. US Attorney General and the US Justice Department have a charge sheet that's about 196 or 164 pages long. And it's all just allegations at the moment. They haven't gone to court. None of these allegations have been proven in the court of law, and it's now the legal process that has to start.
And can you just tell us about these allegations and how the FBI went about investigating this stuff against FIFA?
Well, as everyone knows, for a long time the FBI have been investigating them. The investigation spans about 3 years, if I'm not mistaken, and it goes into corruption that's spread for about 2 decades. And the big turning point came when Chuck Blazer, who is the man who has 2 Trump Tower apartments, one exclusively for his cats.
He has an apartment for his cats, yeah, did you just say? Let's pause there.
Yes. So, if he's a shame, I don't want to, you know, speak too ill of the man. He is himself very gravely ill, and he has colon cancer, and he's in hospital at the moment. But yes, so Chuck Blazer is a former U.S. soccer administrator. He, I wouldn't say single-handedly, but he played a massive role in commercializing and revolutionizing soccer in the United States, and he went from sort of being a soccer dad to being an integral part of the U.S. soccer administration. And he was about to be arrested for avoiding tax a few years ago. And I think he was, from what I remember, this happened, sort of the story came out last year, he was going around on his mobility scooter from his apartment, having probably just fed his cats, where he keeps them in their own Trump Tower apartment. And he faced massive jail time, and he entered into a plea bargain with the FBI, saying, okay, I'm going to go to jail, I'm screwed.
Okay.
But in an attempt to help you with your investigation, I'll assist you, and I'll go a bit further. And through the FBI's investigation, he allegedly wore a wire during the 2012 London Olympics, recording some conversations with FIFA officials, and that all formed part of their investigation. So this has been going on for 3 years, and the timing of the arrest was just really just quite convenient. And like Greg said earlier, it does, you know, I have pictures in my brain of not quite as vivid as his or as bad as his. I sort of saw people wearing Thomas the Tank Engine pajamas and being all, you know, chucked out of bed, having cuddled their, you know, snuggle bunny they've had since they were 7 years old or whatever, being chucked out of their hotel beds in a very posh hotel in Zurich. It was just convenient because everyone was there at the time. So having all these officials that the FBI wanted to talk to and the Swiss authorities wanted to talk to all together in the same place at the same time, it was just a convenient time to carry out these arrests.
Okay, Antoinette, thanks so much for that update. We'll be calling you back in just a second. We're having some trouble with the Skype line.
Okay.
Greg, I mean, there's something that you wanted to mention. Why is the FBI involved with this at all? That's something that I was confused about. I'm just like, sure. I thought the FBI is focused on a lot bigger fish. And what are they doing in football?
No, I don't know if they're focused on a lot bigger fish. These are quite big fish, you know. But I think the thing is, the jurisdiction of the FBI is a lot of what some people are sort of questioning, considering that these arrests took place in Zurich with mostly international representatives from FIFA. But what happened was these FIFA officials who have been indicted were transferring these funds, which are allegedly bribes, through the United States banks. And so because of that, under American law, you can sort of open up indictments and prosecute if anything to do with the crime has gone through the United States. So if the funds went through U.S. banks, then the Americans can charge you and investigate it.
Okay, that makes more sense. And I know a lot of the money being siphoned was actually going through, I think, Bank of America and some of the big banks on that side.
I think so, which makes you wonder about whether some of these banks were involved or knew what's going on. You know, you would have expected them to send it to sort of offshore secret accounts, you know, in Switzerland or the Bahamas or something like that.
I mean, that's how I thought it always goes. But
yeah, but then I guess it's, and it's not only this indicting these FIFA officials, I think, is not only a sign against corruption in football, but also a suggestion that corruption in business will also be punished.
I mean, that's really something I'd like to talk more about, especially on the South African front. Antoinette, I think we have you back. Are you with us?
I think I'm back.
Fantastic. This is much better. Now, Antoinette, thanks for giving us that backstory. Thanks for giving us the backstory. I think it now makes sense. So it sounds like somebody gets caught and they're like, okay, I know I'm going to jail. I'm going to rat out, you know, all my co-conspirators, seems to be the word of the day. Now, could you give us sort of the link with where South Africa comes in? And you mentioned this a bit before, and the figure $10 million came up a few times. So how does the allegations from the U.S. Justice Department at FIFA, how does that now come into play with the 2010 World Cup here in South Africa?
Right. So according to the indictment, and actually as has been proven and admitted by Danny Ordaan, when the bidding started for the 2010 World Cup, these things happen. Gifts happen and handshakes happen and all of these things happen. There were, when Germany won 2006 bid, there were allegations that they were corrupting the bid. So all of these things is just something that does happen. So the indictment alleges that South Africa paid two amounts. One, which was apparently paid in a suitcase, in stacks of however many $100 bills, to the value of $10,000 before the bid. So long before this was, I don't know if this was to prove that, yeah, we're in to give you money, or what the exact situation around that amount was. But this was paid to a co-conspirator who's good friends with Jack Warner again. And it sounds like it was probably Chuck Blazer who picked up that amount of cash. But then later on, Morocco was trying to bribe Jack Warner, and they offered him $1 million. And South Africa had actually said previously that, no, we'll get the government to pay you $10 million, Jack Warner. And they didn't actually end up doing that, the government themselves, but they took the money that was meant to go to the local organizing committee and paying for, you know, things that go with hosting a football World Cup, and they diverted it. So basics of money laundering, there's a fund that's there to go to something. If they actually know, take some of that money and send it somewhere else that's completely legitimate, that will still show that it's a clean audit, and just send it to someone who has control over those accounts. And in this case, it was Jack Warner. So if anybody, and I think Ms. Honourable Minister Fikile Mabalula did mention last week that, you know, that they got a clean audit, and that's absolutely correct, because in the way that it was done, every auditor who looks at it will give whoever's, you know, involved a clean audit, because it was done so cleverly. But the best part of this is that South Africa, in their genius of, you know, corruption, if you want to call it that, just alleged, they actually just shanked FIFA, and they just used FIFA's own money to pay this bribe, as it's being called.
So, and it seems that you definitely believe that this bribe was paid, because you've seen Fikile Mbalula and Danny Ordaan have both denied that there was any sort of bribing or corruption involved. But do you give their defences any weight at all?
It depends what their definition of bribe is, I suppose, because the evidence is here. I'm looking at the letter that was sent to Mr. Falk in 2008, and it says take $10 million and pay it to, from the local organising committee, and pay it to this Diaspora Legacy Program run by Jack Warner. So there is no denying that money exchanged hands between the two parties. On what basis that happened is, I guess, what the FBI and what court proceedings will have to establish, because we don't know. But, you know, this is how things work, not just in football, but also in business. You know, you have to hustle. And if South Africa felt that this was their best way of hustling, then, you know, then that's what they did.
A nation of hustlers, huh? But it seems quite interesting that I think this $10 million, which is now clear that someone, $10 million did change hands at South Africa's request. But I wonder, because I've seen this letter as well, and it just seems odd that if South African football, if we're going to donate $10 million, you know, to this fund, why would we request it to go through FIFA? It seems so strange that we couldn't, if it was a legitimate payment, why couldn't we just pay it ourselves? So it does look like something, they're clearly trying to hide something.
Well, yeah, trying to hide something, and like I said, trying to shank FIFA, because this wasn't FIFA's money to begin with, it was FIFA's money. So they thought, well, hang on a minute, we're not going to take any of our money that we earned and pay it over. We're just going to take the money that belongs to FIFA anyway and give it to someone else. So that is supposed legitimate way of doing it. So it looks clean, but like I said, there's always that do the energy and why are you just randomly playing yourself to someone that's not involved in organizing a World Cup? And why aren't you, if there is a legacy fund that you want funds distributed to, why are you not doing that after the World Cup once you've set up that legacy fund?
Mm. What do you think the chances of a South African being indicted for this payment is? Is there any sort of chance?
Well, that's a difficult question. I've sort of spent the last, since the story, but trying to think about, you know, is it possible and, you know, like how clean are they and so on. Part of me, it depends on what Jack Warner said. So when this news broke, Jack Warner actually first vehemently denied his involvement once again, and then he handed himself over to the police in Trinidad, and then he said he was exhausted, and he went to a political rally, and he was dancing, he was actually fine.
Which is incredible, huh?
Yeah.
The next day.
Yeah, it doesn't sound real. None of this sounds real, and that's the most bizarre thing. I suppose it entirely depends on whether he thinks like he's on Broadway and enters the plea deal and then, you know, directly implicates South African officials, or whether he just keeps quiet and just says, you're right, I'll wait for, you know, legal proceedings to take their course and either gets found out or not.
I mean, it sounds like a lot of it really hinges on, you know, how much he's willing to say to save himself jail time. It sounds like it.
It what? Sorry.
I'm just saying it depends on, it sounds like a lot of it just really rests on Jack Warner and how much he's willing to spill the beans to save himself jail time.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's carried on for so long, and I think that in some people's mind it was just normalized for so long that now that it's all come out, it's a bit like, well, maybe we've convinced ourselves in the back of our minds that what we were doing was completely cool, but it's actually not, you know?
Yeah, it really is surreal. It really is surreal. I think my question is, we've been hearing about corruption at FIFA, maybe not at this level, but we've been hearing about it for some time. So it's, you know, I don't think it's the biggest surprise that there's been dodgy dealings at FIFA. So for me, my question is how does this keep going? Who's voting these people into power? How has Sepp Blatter been in power so long despite continuous allegations of bribery and corruption? So could you just give us an idea on how he stays in power? And
He's like the Mugabe of sports officials.
Yeah, like who's supporting this guy? Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, Seth, love him or hate him, he is a genius politician, and he knows exactly how to play the game. And since he took over in 1998, he has done tremendous work for the game in Africa and in Asia. And what he has done, one, increasing South Africa's participation from 3 to 5, I think, and setting up tremendous grassroots goal projects across the world, specifically in developing nations like Africa and Asia. And those kinds of things, the money that's being plowed into that and taking away the game away from the Eurocentric vision that it had for years before him and before sort of 1974, that wins enormous loyalty, because emerging from colonialism 20 years ago, many of these African nations felt like they were always going to have to fuck around behind teeth of footballing equality. And when somebody in power gives you the opportunity to be part of making global decisions, because a vote in FIFA, everyone gets votes count the same. So whether that's, you know, whether you have 10,000 people living in your country in a little island somewhere, or whether you have 50 million people living in your country somewhere in Europe, your vote is equal to everyone else. And for everyone voting for that, specifically from the African and Asian vote, it's exactly the devil you know and the devil you don't. So there might be some fear that if Seth gets voted out, it will go back to the way it was before, where Europe had the lion's share of profits, they had the lion's share of participation spots at the World Cup, and this grassroots funding that we don't know whether it's always going to the right places, but there might be some fear that these projects might disappear if the support for Blatter stops. And whoever takes over from that, there's nothing to be able to do that without these endorsements. And that's why whoever challenges him will have to, you know, he'll have to say, he's all right, he can take over from me, vote for him, because that has played an incredible political game since he took over almost 20 years ago now.
I mean, you're right. It sounds like, in me just reading his track record, it sounds like he's done actually what is looks like really great work in terms of rolling out the football, not rolling out the football, but rolling out global football into places where they really wouldn't have gotten that kind of spotlight. So places like Southeast Asia, places like the Caribbean, places like Africa. So I think my question, Antoinette, is it worth it? Is it worth it to have somebody that we know is corrupt, but at the same time is really expanding the game to everyone, make sure everyone can enjoy it, make just from a purely utility perspective. We're all enjoying the game. I'm sure some communities and countries that were not seeing any profits are getting some. So, I mean, would you say it's worth it?
Is it worth it?
Yeah.
No, but it's also not worth having someone take over who's going to marginalize and the country, you know. So FIFA needs to be reformed. Of course it does. It's, like you said earlier, it's been corrupt for however long, and it's been okay for it to be corrupt for far too long. But reforming it needs to happen holistically and across the board.
Yeah.
And it can't happen with a Eurocentric vision of saying, Europe is fine. Europe is okay. We're not corrupt. Yes, they are. There's immense corruption in Italian football and, you know, everywhere else in Europe. There's horrible racism happening across various, institutions, associations across Europe, and US aren't doing anything about it. So it's not worth having someone who's corrupt in charge, but it's just there's not other real leader that steps forward and says, you know what, I can do this, and I have Africa and Asia and all the other developing nations' interests at heart.
I mean, I hear you. It's quite disturbing to see this corruption trend also in the leagues and in different sports. But anyway, it's something we'll continue to watch. Antoinette, that's unfortunately all the time we have. Thanks for coming on, and please keep up the great work in writing and reporting on this.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Thank you. Now, Greg, something we were talking about a bit earlier is I'm not sure how to feel as a fan, to be honest, because I enjoyed the World Cup personally. I enjoyed it, and then this stuff came out, and I remember at the start there was all these stories about how FIFA basically got special laws that were but pretty much unconstitutional in South Africa and how they were running the World Cup. And now the stories of corruption come out, and we may or may not have paid $10 million illegally. So I don't know how to feel. Should I feel robbed? I mean, it doesn't really feel like it's my money that went through. I suppose in the long of it, it may be through my, you know, maybe a DSTV payment or something. But on the other hand, I just really enjoy the World Cup, and I really like football. So I don't know. Should I be pissed off? I don't know.
Well, it's not my place to, I guess, tell you if you should be pissed off or not, but I think it's interesting when you look at it because, so if we look at the most recent World Cup in Brazil, you know, there's the well-known example where they forced the Brazilian government to change its laws to allow beer to be sold in the stadiums. I think it was Budweiser, of course.
Yeah.
Which was against the law at that time because I think they'd been trying to stop it.
And there were specific reasons why that was not...
Yeah, to rule out violence at football matches. Yeah. And they actually got them to change the law and create this sort of beer law.
Yeah.
And I think that's one symbol of the processes that FIFA uses when it comes into a country. It's almost like a... You know how we're always... or a lot of people in South Africa and developing countries as well, really hating on these global powerhouses like the United States and Europe and things like that, or institutions like the IMF and World Bank for coming in and setting these policies and forcing countries to go in directions that may not be to their benefit. It reminds me of that in a little way because the processes they go about things are horrible. They run roughshod over local governments.
Oh, yeah.
But
local
at the
business
same
as
local
well,
business and the benefits, the financial benefit and economic benefit they bring to certain countries, if we're specifically talking about the World Cup, is fairly questionable when you look at how much governments have to spend on infrastructure. Like if you look at South Africa, you know, there's the Gautrain, the freeway improvements, the enormous cost of the stadium builds. But on the other hand, I think as a fan, it's a different thing.
It's just a different like place. It's an emotional one. It's fun.
And so I think it is possible to look at back at the 2010 World Cup and say, look, I had a great time. It was exciting having this event in the country.
It was great.
Going, you know, either going to the matches or going to a fan park or just watching with friends at home or in a bar. And you know, all of those little things, like people wearing their jerseys, was it on a Friday or whatever?
Yeah, it was Bafana Friday, that's
And little things like that, and that sort of excitement and buzz around the country and showing the world that South Africa can put on a world-class event.
Yeah.
having the opportunity for Bafana Bafana to perform with the best teams in the world and being able to support them there. I think having South Africa be the center of the world's attention is, and not to mention being able to watch some incredible football at stadiums, you know, not very far away that we can actually attend, is something that can be proud of and look back on with fondness and I think and great memories. But I think at the same time, I think taxpayers should be pissed. If there was corruption where effectively in this intricate deal, where $10 million, you know, so in now's currency, sort of over 120 million odd rand, was siphoned off from the South African fiscus, that's pretty fucking annoying.
I mean, that could have gone to education, that could have gone to healthcare, I mean, that could have gone to anything.
It could have just offset the cost, the
of just the national budget for that year. So yeah, it could have gone to anything else.
That's right. Like, And when you also look at, you know, the revelations that later came out that construction companies were colluding when they were bidding to get tenders to build stadiums and for some of these World Cup infrastructures. Mm. And so they also charged the taxpayer more. Some of those things you have to sort of, as a taxpayer and as a member of the South African nation or someone who lives here and someone who is, you know, concerned about issues of poverty, unemployment, inequality, issues of, you know, your robots not working. Yeah. You have to be, I think you need to be upset or at least questioning and being critical and demanding more information from this. And I've found it a little bit concerning that Sports Minister Fikile Mbalula was much, I understand why, but he, I think, was more on the defense. He went straight into the defense mode.
Yeah.
Rather than, I think he seems like he does want to take the claim seriously, but I would have liked to see him really come out and just say, if this happened, it's wrong and it's messed up and we're going to get to the bottom of this. But I think he sort of veered more towards Russian President Vladimir Putin's approach, which was, it's a plot from the Americans to discredit us and our successes.
I mean, I hear you and I think you're right. There's just two separate issues, man. As a fan, we all had a great time and Tshabalala scored the free kick and it was fantastic. But at the end of the day, you look at the numbers and it's not looking good. There are all these promises of jobs that will be created and that's been shown across many World Cups, not just South Africa's, that doesn't really live up. Mm. And there's the cost of the stadiums and some ex-hosts such as South Korea and Japan actually ended up taking down their stadiums because they just were too big for the country's normal use. So I think there's a lot of questions on World Cup hosting in general, even before you get to South Africa's.
I've seen a lot of people that are just sort of on social media and chatting to some people who are just saying, well, you know, $10 million well spent. Like, I still love the World
Cup.
And even some people being, with all these bribery allegations coming out, they're getting really defensive, saying it was still a great time. You can't take that away from us.
Ish, man, I don't know where to start, man. But I think we'll just continue watching the story and we'll see if the FBI will give the red card to some of the South African politicians involved in this. This is going to go into the break and we'll be talking education just after this with the spokesperson from Equal Education. Tune in to the Daily Maverick Show in just a couple minutes. Thank you. Good afternoon. You're now tuned into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We're just going to the second half of our show. I'm joined in studio by Greg Nicholson and Nombulelo Nyatela, the spokesperson for Equal Education. Nombulelo, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Fantastic. So my thing is I really want to talk about a recent study published by Equal Education that surveyed a percentage of the schools in Gauteng. And was really focused on key aspects of what's actually going on the ground. So we hear a lot of stories around the quality of education and are there toilets, are there textbooks. So it's really great to have somebody actually go from school to school and be like, what's going on here? So Nombulelo, I just want to ask about some of the key findings. I mean, from some of the reading, some of the things sound pretty bleak, to be honest, where we have, you know, people, so many students sharing toilets, no sanitary pads or sanitation facilities, no toilet paper. So could you just tell us some of the main findings from the audit you conducted?
Okay, so it's called a social audit, and really it's powered by the community. It was done by community members. It was done by junior organizers, really going into schools, parents, I'm talking parents, grandparents, some learners themselves were doing these audits, and that's why it's such a powerful tool to get people involved, but also to understand, because there's a person of education and they understand what government owes to them, like what are their rights when it comes to this.
I mean, that's fascinating. I just want to stay on that for a second. So it's a social audit, and you've got parents, you've got learners actually auditing their own schools and communities.
Grandparents, jeez. Yeah. It's and very sort of community organizations like Sidingu Thando, which is really about disabled learners. These are parents that started these organizations. Mm. That's what makes it so powerful.
That's a really great sort of, I mean, we talk about grassroots and we talk about involving communities. I think that's a very literal way to do it.
Absolutely. We copied it from the SJC in Cape Town. Yeah. We did it with their toilets in Khayelitsha. But basically, we found that in about 30% of the schools, 100 learners or more were sharing a single working toilet. We audited 200 schools. That's 10% schools in Gauteng. Yeah. Those were the schools we audited specifically on sanitation. So, and then we found that 1 in 5 toilets was either broken, locked, or not working. We found that in 40% of the schools, the learners don't have any access to any sort of soap in their toilets. And then in 70% of the schools, they also don't have access to any sanitary pads or any tissue. So we found that really there is some sort of sanitation crisis in Gauteng, and that's why our campaigns in Gauteng have been focused on sanitation. But we looked at other indicators as well. So in 75 of the schools, the principals were allowing us to go into their classrooms and to look at what the state was. And we found that in half of the schools, 50 learners or more are sharing a classroom. These are classrooms that are built for about 30 learners or so. So they grossly overcrowded. We found that, you know, in most of the classrooms, they either have a hole in the ceiling or a hole in the floor. We found that there's a mass exclusion of disabled learners. Disabled learners can't access school because they don't have the infrastructure to access those schools. In 80% of those schools, there's a shortage of desks and chairs. So you will find learners either writing on their school bags, writing on their laps, or sharing seats, you know, sitting on top of each other, really.
I'm a little sorry to stop you there, but it's just, it's really sounding quite bleak right now. You're talking about 100 learners sharing a single toilet. There's holes in the floor. There's holes in the wall. I know this is just 10% of the schools, but it sounds like, from, you know, that the findings of the audit were quite tough. Sorry,
just to be clear on the numbers, is this 10% of all of Gauteng schools? Is it all public schools? Is it all township schools? Or like, is there any qualification on that?
It's 10% of like all schools in Gauteng. So we audited 200 schools. Okay. Those 200 schools represent 10% of the schools in Gauteng.
Mm-hmm.
We can sort of approximate, you know. Obviously, it was important for us that we look at township schools and rural schools. How we came about those schools is that the MEC of Education had published a list to say that these are the schools that he was going to fix. These are the schools that are part of his sanitation plan.
Hmm.
So when we approached the schools, we had them. We said, you see, you're on this list, and what we want to see is, has there been improvement? Because the minister promised that he's going to fix your toilets and he's going to make sure that you have enough toilets. And so we entered the schools with these lists, and we showed them, and then they allowed us to sort of go in and audit their sanitation.
So would it be fair to say these are some of the worst schools in terms of sanitation issues because they were listed for improvements, or is this, would this be sort of a symbolic or representative of a much wider trend?
I suppose it is, if you look at it, the worst schools, because in any case, we know that quintile 1, 2, and 3 schools, which are our township schools, mainly, but if you look at other provinces, rural schools as well, these are the worst schools in Gauteng. These are the schools that have infrastructure problems, infrastructure backlogs. And of course, this spills out into many other things, including education outcomes. So even though we speak about infrastructure alone, this affects the learners directly in their everyday teaching and learning.
That's interesting. So if there are 100 students for one toilet,
what
can you explain that, if the effect that would have on someone's school outcomes?
So it's actually quite, we had at the audit summit, one of the learners speak about this, and it's always important for us to have the learners sort of get their voice out there. The only reason they don't come onto the show now is because they're in class, but they are very well able to articulate this themselves. They do it better than I do.
One of your colleagues actually suggested we get a learner.
Oh,
yeah, I was thinking, like, wouldn't listeners wonder, like, why isn't this kid in school?
We should have done that.
They're absolutely brilliant. But this learner said, no, you know, the thing is, I stand in a queue for about 30 minutes to get to a toilet. How this affects me is that sometimes I'm missing out on class because it spills over. Even if I'm waiting at break time, it spills over into class time. And I have to choose between sitting in class and just like relieving myself. And there's learners who will tell you in their testimonials that, you know, if I'm on my period, I don't go to school because, you know, it's just such an inconvenience. So girls miss out on quite a significant, you know, school time. But this is around the country, not just in Gauteng. This is a general problem.
In terms of a time frame, that's like at least a few days a month, right?
Yeah, that a few days a month. And in a year, it's a lot.
Really
in their
up.
School life, it's quite a lot. Yeah.
Mm.
But this speaks to their dignity as well. So these learners who've been, for example, one of the exercises we did in Cape Town, I'll take some of the learners to an affluent school closer to Table Mountain, very nice school. But they understand that this affects their dignity. They don't feel like they're taken seriously, like their education is taken seriously. So it's a matter of dignity as well.
It must make it hard to be motivated too.
Exactly. But also if you're not comfortable in class, if you don't have a desk and a chair, like that's a problem. You know, that is a huge problem. You don't perform to your best, you don't perform to your optimum. And we know that these schools are also some of the schools that underperform, etc.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm curious, what is the reaction of the MEC? So you do the social audit, you put it together and you present it, I imagine, to him, his office and his team. And what does he say? He said he's going to roll out a sanitation plan. This doesn't sound like the results of a sanitation plan. So what happens now?
So this is our second audit. We did an initial audit last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say the results were far worse than the ones we found this time. So I think that there is some improvement. He pledged about 150 million rand after we had a 2,000 member strong march to his office.
Okay.
And that was the rollout of the sanitation. Of course, he has not done everything in the time frame that he gave himself. But, you know, we have to put pressure because, you know, learners can't wait any longer. And so he's always said he's a champion of sanitation, and he made some bold promises at our sanitation audit. He did say...
At this most recent one?
Yes, at this most recent one. He said, you know, the 50 worst schools is going to knock down their... By the time sort of they open after June holidays, he's going to have knocked down the 50 worst schools' toilet blocks and built new ones. He said he's going to refurbish all matric classrooms with their ceilings and floors, etc. All matric classrooms.
Okay.
He made quite a few promises. He said he's going to sort of remove, we're going to have smart boards in all the classrooms. I mean, he spoke quite a bit to this. But I think we asked him for a bit more. We said, you know, MEC...
So you wanted more than the smart rooms in the classroom.
Well, I mean, we want him to sort of set a better standard, for example, for the sanitation ratios, you know? The fact that, for example, in the norms and standards, so Gauteng doesn't have problems like the Eastern Cape has problems, you know what I mean? At least we have access to water, we have access to electricity. So those are not the fundamental basics you have to deal with.
It's about ratios rather
than... Exactly,
he can do more.
Yeah. Exactly. So if he set a better standard for the learners, ratios in their toilets, but also, you know, he's made all the schools Section 21 schools. This means that schools can sort of budget for themselves and decide what they do. Now, in township schools, a learner is given 1,116 rand. That's what learners are sort of subsidized with in their schools. And because these are no-fee schools, they can't pay more. Parents don't have to pay a bit more. That's what a learner is given. But that money must cover everything for the year. Your maintenance, if toilet paper, everything. That's the budget that is given per learner. And so principals are telling us they can't make that budget stretch.
So that's the amount of money the school gets per learners.
Yes.
So if you had 100 learners, it's 100 times 1,100.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Exactly. And schools are then given that... will sort of given that power to decide what they do, the money they can, you know what I mean? But principals have competing priorities. If they have to choose between buying chalk for their many learners because their schools are overcrowded, buying chalk or buying toilet paper or tissue, they're going to buy chalk. And so he needs to give them like a model. If he's saying that money is actually enough, he must give us that model budget and show
this is how we arrived at this figure.
Yes, that it's enough.
Has Equal Education worked out, or does it have any other suggested figure as to how much it does cost to adequately provide for learners? So if that 1,100 isn't enough, has Equal Education suggested, you know, maybe 1,500 per learner is the amount that they need?
We haven't done that costing, but we can obviously approximate that it's a lot more.
Okay.
We imagine that even learners in... So the learners in... in other schools as well, they get far less. But because their parents can top up the money, so there's a formula in how it's worked out. And from the government point of view, the learners in townships and rural schools get more money. But what happens in the end is that actually they're still far lacking behind, because even if you're giving a learner in one of the top public schools 500 rand a month, they're still paying like a lot of, maybe, I don't know, 10,000-12,000 rand a year anyway. It's significantly topped up, and they can afford all these things. They can afford better maintenance, they can afford to build more toilets, they can afford to, you know what I mean, to make things work. And so, I mean, we haven't done the exact costing, but I can tell you that principals are saying it is just not enough. We are struggling. We are struggling to make the money straight.
It sounds like the clear divide between urban and rural schools. I mean, for me, that's where the norms and standards would come into play and say, in this kind of environment, this is what is expected of you, in this kind of environment. But I see from your report saying that the plans to meet the norms and standards are still not public. Could you speak a bit about that?
That makes us really upset. We are a very upset organization.
Okay, just the whole of equal education is pissed off.
Because this issue has been going on for years, hasn't it?
We have been campaigning for 5 years for norms and standards. We finally got the law promulgated in 2013.
So it's in law.
So we,
saying every
law,
school must have ABC.
The law is there, and it has certain time frames.
Okay.
And the first time frame was the plan. So the plans were submitted last year in November 2014.
Okay.
But the time frames run concurrently. It's not like after the year, then we start counting again. So the year is over now, and the minister has had like a long time to look at the plans, longer than the president has had to look at the Farlam Commission, in all honesty. And she still hasn't released the plans. And we are worried that we have, on the 29th of May was the halfway through the first time frame that sort of says in 3 years, in 2016, all schools without water, electricity, all schools made out of asbestos, mud, wood, steel. So basically all schools with inadequate infrastructure must be eradicated. And we don't see how that is going to happen if we don't have plans. We don't have plans to hold anyone accountable. We don't know what the province's plans are. We are worried.
So just, can you just take us a step back? These plans, are they plans submitted by schools that need to change their infrastructure? Or what are the plans exactly?
There's schools submitted by the MECs in the provinces. Mm-hmm. So they were supposed to tell the MEC how they, the minister, how they're going to meet these timeframes, how they plan to make sure that they fix the schools, you know, within the certain timeframes. And we don't know how that's just going to happen if, like, they're not published. Communities can't hold them accountable, but even the, you know, like, they're not feeling confident that their situation is going to change at any point. Like, they have nothing, to hold on to. Yeah, it's concerning.
I'm seeing sort of a sharp contrast between the language and the actions of the MEC and what's coming from you. I was talking to Greg about a bit about this earlier, and often he seems on board with this idea that not enough is being done.
We're talking about Panyaza.
Yeah, and you mentioned seeing him in one of the marches, Greg. You just tell that story.
Yeah, I think there's too much even. Seems to like you're marching to his office, and he'll march with you.
He's in the march saying, we need better from government. It's like,
and he also seems to have a lot of sort of big plans. You know, he came out with this thing that's infuriated some people, the idea of twinning schools. He also seems to have been pushing digital developments in the classroom, things like that.
He's
really been getting a lot of headlines, and he seems to be able to mediate some of the anger against him. But are things working in practice?
He does, I think he does get a bit upset with us because he feels he's a hardworking MEC, and I think that he really is. There are have been some great rollouts from his office.
Okay.
The twinning of the schools is actually coming. Sandton, there's a school in Sandton and one in Alexandra that have already starting.
So it started, it's happening. Okay.
The minister is the one that's meant to release the infrastructure plan. So the Angie Motshekga is the one that's meant to give us these plans, and like, we don't know why she hasn't released them. And so this makes us a bit agitated. So the MECs gave her the plans on time on the 29th of November 2014, and she had time to consider them, and like, now we're here. MEC Panyaza Lesufi in the Gauteng province, we must say, has, you know, always been open to meeting with us. He has marched with us, and he was a little bit upset about the audit, but to be honest, you know, we contacted his office for quite a bit, and he only replied when like 702 was like, listen here.
Oh, wow.
When Radio have got involved.
We're going to ask you now. So there was a bit of pressure from our side, but we have to be honest. Obviously, we always get disappointed when government officials don't meet the exact time frames, because we think even if there's one learner in a classroom doesn't have a desk, or there's like one school where learners are sharing a toilet, 100 of them are sharing a toilet, I think that's one too much. It's one too many. It's not fair. It's not fair that these learners have to continue to study under these conditions. So we have a sense of urgency. One government to have a sense of urgency on the matter.
And I hear you. So it sounds like things are happening, but just not fast enough, and it's just not good enough is what it sounds like.
Or I was wondering around the country. So it's in Gauteng, it does sound like things are happening a little bit. But then I worry about the whole country's developments, considering if the basic education minister can't even release these plans for how to fix the norms and infrastructure problems. I worry on a national level, are things developing?
We have seen some really, really bad schools in the country. We have seen in the Eastern Cape some schools that are on a mountain, and it's just like a shack, and these learners study in these conditions, and there's no toilet, and there's no fence, and they walk far, and they are small little children, and the teacher wears like an overall because she gets dirty, and she would rather wear that in the classroom. So this speaks to also the working conditions of the teachers, and speaks to the learners and how they study. We've seen some really bad conditions, and so every time there's a delay, and every time like things are not happening, that is every minute these learners, when it's raining, can't go to school because the shack leaks. When it's too hot, they have to sit outside because it's just too much. They are overcrowded. They don't have desks. They don't have chairs. You know, it's like they don't feel like their education is being taken seriously. They take the time out to go to school. They are committed to education, and government needs to commit to making sure that their education is a quality education and equal to everyone else's in South Africa.
Mm. Is it difficult for you personally to be continually exposed to, I guess, the extreme challenges of South African students? You know, you have these young people who want to learn, and their education is their future, but then they're facing so many challenges. Is that a difficult thing to continually be engaging with?
I mean, I think it's obviously, it's not easy to watch, but I imagine that we are just watching, South Africans are just watching. When we watch ENCA, we're just seeing footage, but these learners that sit in those classrooms have it far harder than we do. Yeah. But every day still wake up and go to classroom. And so every time our learners and our members of Equal Education are marching, we know that it's really from the bottom of their hearts, and it's with everything they have. And they know, some of them know that they may never, they may leave school and never see the changes, but they know that it has to be like a generational struggle, that they have to do something about it.
I mean, thank you for keeping up the good fight. And I'm just curious what happens next. So you've done the social audits, the results have come out, we're still having delays from the Minister's Office and the MEC. What's sort of the next thing that Equal Education is looking towards?
Well, we keep at it. Eastern Cape marched on Friday, demanding the plans again, and we have some sort of promise that they will be released.
Okay.
And we will monitor like we always do, and keep at it, you know, hold government accountable, and our learners are always on the ball.
Okay.
They're always meeting and trying to do things better. And we have a number of campaigns running on scholar transport. So we are really on the ground and trying to make things better in the education system.
Okay, and how can people get a hold of you to either be part of the march or support your work? I mean, how can the rest of us get involved?
So you can contact us you can tweet at us at @equal_education.
Yep.
Or you can Facebook us at Equal Education. Or you can email us on info@equaleducation.org.za.
Okay, fantastic. Nombulelo, thank you so much for coming on the show, and please keep up the great work.
Thank you for having
us. And of course, a big thank you to my partner in crime, Greg Nicholson. A big thank you.
Good to be here again.
Fantastic. Please make sure to download the podcast and share it with all your friends. This is the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We will see you next week.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.